And now Erica Ross. Thank you.
Good morning to you all, and thank you for allowing me to be here. Thank you for braving the weather as well. I don't really mind the winters of Montana, but not in 1 week. I am from Oklahoma. My name is Erica Ross, and unfortunately, since May couldn't be here, I'm the stand-in. I do hope that soon Meg would be able to come again and speak with you guys. As a member of ACLU, she has... Is that better? Okay. As a member of ACLU, she certainly has an insight that I don't have. But I hope to be able to address you today with some of the work that I've been doing, as well as to encourage non-Native allyship with our Indigenous communities here in Montana. Being born and raised in Oklahoma, Oklahoma has the most tribes of any state in our nation, with 37. And Oklahoma's particular relationship with Indigenous tribes is nothing like we see here in Montana. It's very strained. And an incredibly difficult relationship. Here in Montana, the state legislators and the community has done really beautiful things to make that relationship strong between tribal nations and between non-Native nations across Montana. We have seven reservations here across Montana, 12 tribes, 13, depends on who you ask. Sometimes the way that we divide the Sioux ends up being one extra tribe. But the tribes that are here make up about 6% of Montana's total population. Unfortunately, though, missing and murdered Native women make up 30% of all of Montana's missing population. For the missing and murdered Indigenous crisis particularly, it's an international crisis. I'm not sure if anyone has heard of it before. But it's an international crisis that impacts us here in America as well as Canada and even the Indigenous peoples of Mexico. Canada has recognized it as a crisis among the First Nations people and has called a national inquiry into the problem. But in the U.S., the government here has recognized the missing and murdered Indigenous crisis as a day that we should be aware of and the day that we should honor in remembrance of for May 5th. But so far, the federal government has not launched any official inquiry as to what's happening in that crisis. Unfortunately, nearly every state that has a significant Native American population shares some of the same statistics I'm about to give you. I know that numbers can be a little overwhelming, so I'll try not to provide you too much. But I think it's worth noting some of the dangers that Native women face. Native women experience murder at a rate 10 times the national average. The third leading cause of death for Native women aged 10 to 24 is murder. Native women are assaulted at 2.5 to 3.5 times more than any other demographic of women. 84% of Native women have experienced violence, and 56 have experienced specifically sexual violence. 9 out of 10 victims designate their attacker to be non-Native. About 96% of cases of violence against women are caused by non-Native men. So when we imagine this international crisis, we have to acknowledge our role as non-Native communities in this issue. I want to give you some background as to why this crisis is ongoing and today's particular theme of justice for Indigenous people. I want to talk about what justice for Indigenous people may look like. In 1885, the federal government enacted the Major Crimes Act, and essentially it undermined tribal sovereignty with their ability to prosecute jurisdictional charges of certain crimes in their area. The FBI took over jurisdiction for major crimes like manslaughter, murder, kidnapping, larceny, arsony, and that whole list has grown to about 15 crimes altogether that the FBI reserves the right to prosecute, taking away the jurisdiction from tribes. And the reason this happened is because the federal government didn't feel like tribal justice was enough. Before colonizers got here, tribes had a long-standing way of dealing with problems in their community. The FBI, though, and the federal government felt that the way... Oh, thank you so much. Just getting over the cold that everyone's getting over. Thank you, I appreciate that. The federal government felt that the way that tribal justice had been enacted prior to colonization was not up to European standards. So in 1885, the Major Crimes Act really eliminated tribes' ability to prosecute serious and severe crimes on their own. And that law, even though it was passed in 1885, still reigns true for tribal nations today. In 1978, the Supreme Court ruled on a case called Oliphant v. Suquamish Indian Tribe. It was a situation where a non-native man was on the Suquamish Indian lands and committed a crime. It was a silly crime, a drunken disorderly. But when he was arrested by tribal police and was told that he would be prosecuted in tribal court for his actions, he argued that the tribe did not have the right to punish him because he was not a member of their community and therefore was not subject to their law. This went all the way to the Supreme Court, and unfortunately the Supreme Court ruled in this man's favor, agreeing that non-native people could not be held to tribal law. And when I imagine this, I always try to put this into something that maybe we as a non-native community might be able to feel a little bit better. If someone from Idaho or Wyoming were to come into our state and commit crimes here, they would be held responsible for the crimes they commit in our community because we've decided a way that we provide justice is to keep everyone safe and to prosecute people even if they're not our citizens. Unfortunately, though, tribes don't have that right. 1978, that ruling still impacts tribes today, and there was a slight overturn of that in what's called the Tribal Law and Order Act, and it gave a little bit of rights back to the tribe. It allows tribes to prosecute non-native people who commit minor offenses, but the most extreme punishment they can give is 3 years in jail. So if there is a particularly violent interaction with domestic abuse or anything of that nature, the person being prosecuted and sentenced for 3 years may not actually feel like justice for the community that that person has harmed. We've had a century's worth of federal Indian law and policy that's really devastated tribal courts and tribal sovereignty and the ability for tribes to protect themselves. Here in Bozeman, we would fight hard for our ability to protect the citizens of Bozeman. And so it's interesting to me that when people learn about this, why we don't also fight for tribal nations and their rights to be able to protect their own citizens. The missing and murdered Indigenous women issue, unfortunately, sees no particular end in sight. As of now, there are roughly 5,712 Native women noted as missing or endangered. But the significant problem that we see with some of these statistics and some of these numbers is there is no central database that collects all this information. On tribal reservation or tribally owned land areas, it's not uncommon to see different types of land designations within that boundary. For instance, there could be federally owned land next to state owned land, next to tribally owned land, all within reservation boundaries. And if there is a crime that occurs inside the reservation, we first have to ask two main questions. One being who committed that crime? Was it a native or a non-native person? Because that immediately is going to determine if tribal police can continue investigating. And we have to ask where that crime occurred. What land designation did this happen on? It will determine who gets called to handle the investigation and the prosecution of the crime. As you can imagine, that is a nearly impossible double question scenario for any crime to answer, especially when it's in the case of a murdered Indigenous person, a murdered Indigenous woman. That person can't answer the questions as to who their perpetrator was, and they can't say with any certainty where the crime occurred compared to where the woman may have been found. So the complications are many, and the jurisdictional quagmires that occur are problems that create issues over and over and over. Tribes lack the ability to take control in these situations and to, at whatever cost, find the perpetrator of these crimes because of all of these legal boundaries. I think that as non-Native people, when we hear about things like this, sometimes we think that it's nearly impossible. How could a community live like that? How could any community still have the determination and the ability to continue on with having just a glimpse at many of the restrictions that tribal nations face? As a non-Native aspiring ally, I think it's incredibly important that we take the lead from Native tribes and Native communities. We have to listen to what they need and what they are designating as helpful. It's really easy for us to say that we're helping, but if someone of that community isn't guiding our helping efforts, then we could be doing more harm than good, just because of all of the complications that tribes face at nearly every turn with legal boundaries. This particular week in Helena, next week in Helena, March 13th, there will be a hearing for Indigenous Peoples Day in the Senate. And there will also be we're encouraging everyone that can be there to be there. As a non-Native aspiring ally, one of the best things that we can do is just to show up and be a body to be counted, to be witnessed by the legislators that are making these new laws that impact Indian country. It's important that we show our legislators, our representatives, that we as non-Native people agree with what tribes want for themselves. When it comes to issues like missing and murdered Indigenous women, we have to take the lead from those communities to listen to what it is that they need the most. There's a lot of reasons when we consider why situations like missing and murdered Indigenous women continue, but those jurisdictional loopholes and boundaries and all of those different hopscotch games that law has to play with tribal nations is predominantly the issue. Native people are not inherently victims. They are targeted. I think it's really important that we frame Native peoples in a way that we would want ourselves to be framed. That we are strong, capable people of leading a community of ourselves and being members of a larger community. And tribal nations are no different. And tribal peoples are no different. But with all of these different types of laws and restrictions, it makes it nearly impossible for tribes to protect themselves and their citizens. I know that we had the beautiful song we just heard was incorporated from Standing Rock and from someone's experience at Standing Rock. And I would trust that nearly everyone in this room then, because of that relation, knows at least about Standing Rock in some way or another. When we think about things like Standing Rock and we think about the protest that occurs, it's so much more than just things like oil and protecting the land. Resource extraction is one of the leading dangers to Native communities. and not that resource extraction or the companies themselves are inherently vile. I suppose maybe that could be an argument, but the resource extraction companies, when they come into a place, let's take the Bakken oil field, for example, in North Dakota. When they arrive at a place, they have to make camps for the workers. And I don't know if we have any oil workers in here, but I was raised with people in my family that worked oil. And when you are an oil worker, you work a really different kind of schedule. Normally, it's like a week on, where you leave your home and you go to the location, you work for a week, and then you'll get 4 or 5 days off. And then you'll go back for 4 or 5 days, and then you'll get a week off. And overall in the month, it equals out to almost about like working for 3/4 of the month and being off for 1/3 of the month. But they work in different ways than we work a regular 9-to-5. Because of that, oil companies erect what we identify as man camps. There are these large camps with prefab homes, and it allows the men that are going to work at these locations, I guess not all men, but the employees, it allows them a place to stay while they are on shift for a week at a time, 10 days at a time, etc. But the oil companies have restrictions of these man camps as far as like who can be there. Most of the time, families cannot come with their loved one who is an employee of that company. The camp is really just for the employee. And because oil companies and the physical labor of working in oil employs mostly men, then that's where we get the idea of the man camp. And just recently, nationally, in the election, we heard a lot of talk about locker room talk and the mentality of locker room mentality. And I really have a hard time believing that men inherently are bad people. Because I know that they're not any more than women are. And I know that men in a group are not inherently any more dangerous than women in a group. But something happens when locker room talk and things like that are casual. It pervades a sense of authority over peoples that are being mocked in that conversation. And for places like the Bakken oil field and the man camps that are there, that means that the targets are Native communities, because those are the communities closest to those oil fields. Man camps actually impact local communities pretty heavily. In the first year of a man camp that arrived in the Bakken oil field, rape charges increased threefold. The local community spent more than $1 million in the first year of that company's arrival, spent more than $1 million in fines and fees and repairing the city and all of the things that comes when you just have a massive boom in economy. Those we also identify as boom towns, a town where previously the economy may not have been particularly strong, but now with a surge of employment from the oil camps and the oil industries, the economy explodes. And there's a lot of benefit to that, but there are incredible drawbacks too. For example, the cost of local housing skyrockets. Food and gas skyrocket. Services are also difficult to come by and are often expensive. Native women actually receive a drastic pay gap from a working white male, more than any other demographic. They are paid 57 cents for $1 that a white man would earn. When we consider that, we know that in those boomtown areas, it makes it really difficult for a Native woman who's relying solely on her own paycheck to make it. It makes it even more difficult if that Native woman is in a bad relationship. It makes it less likely that she can get away, less likely that she can move or uproot herself or her kids or her family to find a safer environment. So Native women are impacted the most when we see these boom towns because they get paid the least. We also have to consider different aspects of justice for Indigenous people And one of those aspects is common conversation. In my experience teaching the 105 class and my experience being raised in Oklahoma, more people know myths and misconceptions about Native people than they know realities about Native identity and Native life. And that's a really big problem. It's a big problem for our education system. Our current education system really only frames Indigenous people in a historical context, and we maybe might talk about them when it's Thanksgiving time. But for the most part, kids growing up in the public education system don't particularly have an experience to interact with anything Indigenous at all, except for those myths and except for those misconceptions. So it's not necessarily the fault of all of our nation. I mean, our education system certainly has a role in that to play. But we have to encourage common conversation and local media to be a part of a positive conversation about Indigenous peoples and to be a part of the reality of a conversation of Native peoples. Recently, the Billings Gazette announced that they are going to be devoting a regular space in their news production to the discussion of missing and murdered Indigenous women. It was just announced last week. And I think that that is wonderful. We have a news community that is willing to devote a particular space to talking about women in our area that are going missing, that are being murdered, and that are Native American. But I think that we can also demand more. We need to be asking more from the Bozeman Chronicle, from the local magazines, from our local news stations, that this is a crisis that is covered regularly, that justice for Indigenous people is an issue that is covered regularly. We have to rely on those services to provide education that maybe we didn't get in schools because those schools were unprepared to teach us. So as proud as I am and happy as I am that the Billings Gazette is doing that, I see it more as a foothold in that door, to open that door wider and to really press upon our local media to follow in their footsteps. Missing and murdered Indigenous women rarely make the news. They rarely make conversation. They rarely make notations in the newspaper, magazines, or anything. It's been my experience while studying this particular issue and working with the people that I've worked with that the families of these missing or murdered women often rely on social media as a way to get their voice heard, like Facebook. And although I am a user of Facebook myself, I don't feel like that is the platform where someone needs to be begging to find their daughter. It really should be much greater than that. So we have to do more in our local conversation. We have to make sure that this doesn't fall silent. Crimes against Indigenous women aren't new. They have been occurring since colonization. So then that begs the question, why then are we hearing it as a new sort of conversation? And the answer to that is because people are being loud enough to be heard. Activists alongside that crisis are being loud enough to try to get that word out. Non-Native allies are being loud enough to try to silence some of the background noise and allow Indigenous people to come and speak for themselves and to say what it is that they need and how it is that we can best help them. So although this has gained current fuel to the fire and there's greater conversation occurring about this, this is not where we stop. This is only the beginning. We have to acknowledge that racism plays a large part in justice for Indigenous people. I think in our current political climate, it's not particularly easy to talk about racism or to talk about differences. However, it needs to happen. Without naming names, we have someone in our own government system who mocks the idea of Pocahontas. by referring to people who might be Native as being a Pocahontas. The reality of her story is that she was 10 years old when she met John Smith. It's nothing like the Disney movie that we've seen. It's a rather violent story of rape and of kidnap. And she was real. She represented her community. She was taken from her community. Her story deserves to be remembered respectfully, as well as referring to other people shouldn't be an insult to her memory or the memory of all Indigenous people who have fought against colonization. We have to challenge things like that when we hear that. And we have to be willing to stand up and say, you know, I don't know that that's the right thing to do. I feel like in this particular age where we can do the spit tube DNA tests, it is kind of fun for a lot of people to see where they might come from. But as it stands now, there is not one single tribe in our nation that accepts that as proof of identity. Not one single tribe. And that might change in the next 30 or 40 years. That may evolve. That'll be a tribal determination. Tribes get to determine how they view enrollment in their community and who they consider to be a member of their community. So even if we do have people that are disassociated from their past and from their ancestry, and they may have refound that association through some of these new types of technology, for Indigenous people, that's a really dangerous game that we play of, again, colonizing identity. So we have to be careful, and we have to know that that's really sensitive for Indigenous communities. Suddenly, it seems like it might be cool to be Native if you just find out using those type of DNA tests. But the reality of that can be really insulting to people who are full in their Indigenous identity and who have struggled with their Indigenous identity because of colonizing efforts and because of racism from mainstream America. I encourage all of you guys here, you've taken the first step in wanting to come and hear this, but continue this. Continue wanting to know more. Continue wanting to be educated. Ask questions. Find out why those laws exist. Dig through federal Indian law. That's a slippery slope, I'm telling you right now. That's a wormhole that you can go down pretty deep. Federal Indian law and policy is the oldest form of law that we have in this country, predating the creation of our country, as a matter of fact. So all of those things have a long history. But those historical ideas represent people now, and they confine people now. So coming up March 13th, when we hear if the Senate is going to pass Indigenous Peoples Day, I encourage you all, if you are trying to be a better ally to Indigenous communities, to be there as a physical body to show that you support this movement for Indigenous communities, and to show that you support their leadership in making new changes to our state and to Bozeman and to their own reservation communities that help them to be safer, that help them to be empowered, and that help them to feel good. Missing and murdered Indigenous women is a really hard topic to get into, to discuss, to read about. But we don't make changes by not approaching it. Right now, there's Hannah's Act is also up for legislation. Hannah's Act, supported by the mother of a murdered Indigenous woman, is set to be heard from for our Senate, and they will decide as well if that continues to go on. And just like for Indigenous Peoples Day, I also encourage you to support that as well. Show up physically and be there to support in those hearings. Thank you again for allowing me to be here today, and I will encourage Meg to come. I think what she would have to say to you guys, you would really enjoy from her perspective from the ACLU. Thank you again.
Thank you, Erica. In the words of Mother Teresa, love cannot remain by itself. It has no meaning. Love has to be put into action, and that action is service. Whatever form we are, able, disabled, rich, poor, it is not how much we do, but how much love we put in the doing. A lifelong sharing of love with others. I welcome Terry Bradley.
Good morning, everyone. To give some background to this, I originally wrote this piece as a response to a final project for one of my honors classes a little over a year ago. And the prompt was to creatively portray something in your life that was a disturbance. And this is it. The piece is titled You See. You see, my existence is a disruption, a living memory, a constant reminder of a history that was so harshly, intentionally, purposefully, deliberately, savagely, forgotten in this world we've written, where not only the printed lies are white, but so is the paper. You see, while the history of my people is offered as an alternative course tailored to white curiosity, white history is the standard, the default. It's the white noise when nothing is broadcasting. Yet, when I speak up, I'm the angry Indian, or the indigenous expert. The token native to be exchanged for treaty checks, fee waivers, diversity quotas. You see, I find it ironic that the only coin now deemed worthless has copper skin. Because at this campus, according to this college, you'd think I could paint with the colors of the wind. You see, 92%, the lowest it has ever been, of students identify as white. As a native, I'm a collector's item, a rare find. I am deemed brave, strong, unique. You see, they never see me. I'm always something more or less. My accomplishments are always in spite of the color of my skin, yet my failures are always dependent on it. Constantly, I think about what I say, what I do, how I say it, how I do it. Will they listen? Will they see? Will they ignore it? Because I'm native? You see, I'm still trying to learn how not to get caught. So I talk using the mother tongue of those who oppress me. So I dress with the clothes of those who despise me. So I act like those around me as not to draw any attention to my differences. I do this not for me, but for we. We who never saw high school graduation. We who are more familiar with iron bars than textbooks. We who know what it means to go without food or heat. We who are so removed from our traditional ways, and so we adapt, assimilate. Attempt to blend into the concrete walls so the spotlight never finds us. Never to be glorified as an individual, nor shamed as a racial representative. I am here simply to survive. in a society designed to eliminate me, and in that I am thriving. You see, the new war cry isn't protests and policy changes. It's laughter. The echo of trauma, strength, and healing. A song of resilience. You see, to survive in this world means that they have not won, that we are still here. I'll say it again. We are still here. It is never a factor of if we succeed, but when. 3 times more likely to drop out, to commit suicide, to try harder, to work more, to show up. You see, the value of that degree is much more than a better future for myself, but a better world for us all, a better chance to survive. You see?